Tillamook Chocolate Collection ice cream is a total chocolate game changer. We start with unbelievably creamy dark chocolate ice cream. Then we add different chocolate treats, like chocolate cookies, chocolate cake, or chocolate brownies, to make four decadent chocolate flavors. Because sometimes the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection ice cream. Extraordinary dairy.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Welcome to another edition of Nightmare Fuel Creeps and Peepers. I'm Dan Cummins, and I'll be sharing another original short story of the fictional horror variety. My twist on the traditional haunted house tale this time. I highly recommend noise cancellation headphones for the best experience. Hope you enjoy this new nightmare. Time now for the tale of the Children of Midnight.
Daddy, no!
Little Polly screamed. Her face was puffy from crying. Snot ran from both her nostrils as she sobbed. Her right hand was covered in her mother's blood, and splotches of more blood could be found on the same side of her romper. Megs, her mother, was begging for her life. She'd already been stabbed 3 times. Once in the shoulder, a blow she'd partially blocked that was meant for her heart. And twice more in the back after she'd fallen and tried to crawl away. The second and third strikes had hit bone, and not a lung or some other organ. Or she'd been in even worse shape than she already was. She'd barely managed to fight off her attacker and run to her daughter, grabbing her by the hand and then running with her towards the stairs that led to the main landing and to escape outside of the house. But she hadn't made it. He'd grabbed Polly. Megs had turned and screamed, "Dominic, stop! This isn't you! Stop! Please don't do this!" But he didn't stop. He pulled his 6-year-old daughter back and callously tossed her aside. And he swung the knife again. Megs threw out her arms to try and block a deadly blow once more. The heavy blade sunk into her forearm and then glanced off bone. Again she delayed what was seeming more and more inevitable by the second. Polly screamed, even more desperately than the time before. Dominic was now looking down at his daughter, their daughter, and holding the bloody knife in his hand tighter than ever, his knuckles white and the veins in his forearm bulging. He didn't want to. But he had to. It was the only way. It would all stop. It would never, ever stop if he didn't finish this. He was raising the blade to plunge it down into her heart.
No! Dominic!
Megs now lunged at her attacker, at her husband, but her scream was interrupted by the knife being buried up to the hilt in the top of her stomach. When she jumped towards him, Dominic turned his attention away from his daughter, who was still screaming, flailing her arms up and down and almost hyperventilating, wanting so badly to run to her dying mother, to save her from the monster that was her father, but also so afraid of what that monster would do to her. And he had delivered his death blow.
"Please, Dominic,"
Megs now pleaded.
"Not Polly. This isn't you.
It has to end!"
Dominic roared as he straddled his wife, sitting on her hips and plunging the knife down again and again and again. He kept stabbing her long after she was clearly dead. And now, wild-eyed and snarling and covered in her blood, he turned to face his daughter.
"Daddy, why?"
Because he had to. But then he hesitated for just a moment. Could he really kill his daughter as well? Did she also have to die? Hadn't he done enough to appease him? Hadn't enough of a sacrifice been made? A large, formidable-looking dark entity, a human body with angel wings and the head of an owl, stood behind Polly, staring at her father. It nodded. "Yes. Yes, you do have to." As it pulled back on the chain that kept a dangerous and massive black demon wolf directly in front of it at bay, The entity reminded him that more must still be done. More blood, more sacrifice. Dominic reminded himself that if he just did as it asked, his wife and daughter's souls would not be damned. In death, they would still yet live forever and in peace. That was the deal. And then he could just sacrifice himself as well. It promised him this, that he could join them. Dominic smiled, a mad smile. The smile of a broken man whose mind has been hopelessly, irrevocably twisted. They'd all be together again, soon. They'd all be safe and happy, forever. Dominic grabbed the messy bun that sweet, innocent little Polly always wore atop her head, his fingers plunging into her thick, long, sun-bleached hair. And she grabbed his wrist with her little girl hands that weren't able to stop him. She frantically shook her body and cried and screamed as her father, with the dark angel and his black wolf watching, pulled her head towards his body as he pushed the knife forward, thrusting hard and burying it in her chest. He would only have to stab her small body once. He was thankful it was quick. She barely made a sound, and after a few moments, he let go of her hair, and her limp body tumbled down, sprawling out onto the floor, blood pooling from beneath it. He met his dark angel's steady gaze, and it nodded with approval. He had done as it had commanded. And now he raised the knife to finish it, to cut his own throat. But the entity moved its head from side to side. No, not like that. The knife fell from Dominic's hand immediately. He wasn't sure if he had unthinkingly obeyed its command and dropped it on its own, or if the angel had used its magic to take it from him. What now? What more? He silently wondered. Before the thought was even finished, Dominic was given his answer. The devil's angel let go of the chain, and the demon wolf, snarling, leapt forward through the air, jaws snapping open to reveal rows of long, thick, razor-sharp fangs. It was going to tear him to pieces. It was going to devour him. After all he'd been through, after all he'd done, Dominic no longer believed he was even capable of feeling fear, and yet he was petrified, and he screamed. He was still screaming when he awoke and shot bolt upright in bed. And he was crying when his wife Meg sat up next to him, his wife who was not covered in blood and very much alive, his wife who was not scared of him but instead worried about him. And she threw her arms around him and reassured him that everything was okay, that it was all just a dream. And she was mostly right. It was a dream, but not just a dream. Everything was not okay. Something was wrong, so very, very wrong with their new home. It was evil. And his dream was either a warning or a premonition. That was just one of the nightmares I had in the house. One of many. Fun, huh? Like everyone else who was a kid back in the early 2000s, or really anyone who was a kid going all the way back to the 70s, when the original Exorcist movie came out, I've long been familiar with the concept of some person becoming demonically possessed. I could never make up my mind on whether or not I believed that demonic possessions were real, but at the very least, I was quite familiar with what it supposedly looked like, and I knew that a lot of other people very much believed in the absolute reality of this phenomenon. I'm sure you either believe in demonic possession yourself, or are very familiar with others believing in it. I mean, who hasn't heard of it? But did you know that a house can also become demonically possessed? As in, just like how that little girl in The Exorcist was possessed by the spirit of the devil, and the devil took control of her body and mind and used her like a puppet to make her say and do horrible things, the devil, or some other demon or demons, can do the same thing to an inanimate object, even a really big object, like an entire house. I didn't know that. I certainly do now. Now I believe in this possibility, this certainty, with every fiber of my being. I became a believer in the worst kind of way. I lived in one of those houses. Let me tell you how I ended up there. It all started early last fall when Megs and I decided to shake up our lives and open a bed and breakfast. But let me back up a bit more, actually, to how Megs and I met. I'd moved from Portland to Astoria almost 15 years ago when I got my first teaching job at Astoria High School, English and World History. A few years after that, I met my wife Megs on Tinder, actually. She was working for a Portland production company called Visceral Productions. And I was still visiting Portland often to hang with my college friends and not worry about any students or students' parents seeing me out on a date or getting a bit sloppy at a bar and hoping to hook up. And I really didn't want to risk accidentally dating a student's older sister or mom. After Megs and I dated for a few years, both of us grew tired of traveling back and forth between Portland and Astoria. And Megs decided she'd built up enough production contacts and had made enough of a name for herself in the industry to start freelancing. So she moved in with me in Astoria, and a year later, we were married. Then with her able to edit at home for the most part, only taking trips here and there to Portland and LA for occasional better-paying jobs, and with me having my summers and weekends off, we decided to try for a kid. And in the summer of 2017, on June 12th at 4:07 p.m., she gave birth to our third musketeer, beautiful little Polly Grace. I now found myself madly in love with two girls, and I desperately wanted to spend as much time as I could with both of them. Summers have long been my favorite time of year. I used to really, truly love teaching before shitty students, raised by even shittier parents, who were, of course, the first to chew your ass for not teaching their kid correctly, really killed that for me. But even before that, I still love being off for the summer more than I ever loved being in the classroom. And now with Polly, it was getting harder and harder to want to go back to school in the fall. I wanted to stay home with my girls. I wanted to find a new career where maybe I could also work from home with Megs. Megs and I have both always been good when it comes to saving money. And now we started saving more aggressively. And the more we saved, the more possible it felt to reimagine our lives and make a big change for me, for our family, possible. And Megs had also been looking for a change ever since Polly arrived. She still loved editing, but she was getting tired of bouncing down to LA and over to Portland, which was becoming more and more of the norm if she wanted to keep getting good work. And she was getting frustrated by seeing less talented peers leapfrog her because they were willing to work in an office or on location whenever and wherever to be around a network and schmooze. We kept talking and talking and talking. What if we could really both find some way to work from home all the time? Both be able to spend so much more time with little Polly before she'd grow up and leave the house. And then it felt like we received a miracle. 2 years ago, Meg's favorite aunt, Joy, her great aunt, actually, passed away. Even though she was 91, it still messed Meg's up pretty bad. Joy was like another grandmother to her, another grandmother she found out she didn't know as well as she thought she did. Joy was rich. We had no idea. She'd married this really nice but quiet guy, Gregory, about a decade ago. And when he died before she did, he'd left her everything. And his everything was a lot. Because they'd lived so modestly and thanks to neither of them ever having kids, no one had any idea. But now Meg's got a substantial inheritance. We got it. A really, really big inheritance. The kind I'd never actually known anyone to get. $2.6 million after taxes. We were beyond shocked. I don't even have the words to describe how completely blown away we were. Even after the money was in our bank account, we were still afraid to touch it for several weeks. No matter how many times we opened our banking apps and looked at the numbers, they didn't feel real. We kept waiting for her estate attorney to call and let us know there had been an error. Someone had clearly made a mistake, a big mistake. This couldn't actually be happening, could it? It could. And it did. There was no mistake. Now we could really dream, no, plan about how we were going to reimagine our lives. Soon after this life-changing moment, we were spending the day down in Seaside, just 30 minutes from our house. And the three of us were walking past all these big, beautiful bed and breakfasts. The owner of one was out working in her front garden by the sidewalk, trimming back some rose bushes. And we said hello, asked if she knew who the owner was, found out it was her, and got to talking. By the end of our conversation, we knew exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to stay on the Oregon coast. It really is so beautiful and just feels like where we're supposed to be. And we wanted to buy and run our own bed and breakfast. Once this idea hit us, we realized it wasn't nearly as random as it might first appear to our friends and family. It truly suited our skill sets. I'm pretty handy with repairs, and I've always loved to cook. Pretty damn good at it, if I do say so myself, especially breakfast. And Megs is a natural hostess with an incredible eye for interior decorating. and she makes the best chocolate chip cookies you've ever had, and a bunch of other delicious baked goodies. And we both love meeting new people and entertaining. It felt like our destiny, like we'd been actively preparing for this new adventure for years and just hadn't realized it. Within an hour of talking with that bed and breakfast owner, I wish I could remember her name, we were meeting with Amira Walton, our new realtor. I'll never forget her name. And Amira had the perfect place for us. Actually, she was about to send us into hell, but at the time, it sure felt like the perfect place. She told us that a massive 8-bedroom, 8 different suites, each with their own bathroom, Queen Anne Victorian mansion, about 5 miles southeast of Seaside, along Bierman Creek, in this big, beautiful valley on the edge of a massive 350-acre land conservancy, had just come up on the market. It wasn't in town or near the beach, like the kind of place we thought we wanted when we first walked into Amira's realty building, but it was gorgeous. A beautiful getaway that felt like you were all alone, miles and miles away from the rest of the world, but really, you were less than a 10-minute drive from any little shop, cafe, or restaurant in Seaside. You had the best of both worlds. Quiet, natural beauty, and lightning-fast Wi-Fi and 5G cell service. Built in 1903, the property needed some fixing up, but was only priced at just over $1 million. We were astonished. We had the money to both buy it and shine it up and make it sing, as Meg said. We slept on the decision for a few nights. Or maybe it was only one night. We were so damn excited. And then we made our offer, and it was promptly accepted. Of course it was. The previous owners could not wait to get rid of it. Amira did tell us that the home had run through its fair share of owners, but she downplayed why. No, she straight up lied as to why. She said that none of them were, in her opinion, willing to put in the work it needed to be properly restored. Bullshit. She knew. I don't believe for a second now that she didn't know exactly what was really going on. She'd lived in Seaside for years, and she was the listing agent for several of those sales. That possessed house has made her a lot of money. Maybe she made a deal with it. From what I've figured out since we left, the house has had no less than 21 different owners over the last 56 years. The owners before all that, the ones that left in 1968, they'd lived there for over 10 years. And before them, there was just one family. So where did it all go wrong? I now know that it all started with the second owners. That's where things went wrong. Everyone else who left afterwards, the alarming amount of people who died there, that was all due to the house being possessed by Andras. And God knows how many other demons he employed to torment anyone who has dared to enter that house in over 50 years now. I sound insane, right? Some madman rambling about a big demon and his minions? Let me tell you the whole story. Starting with the day we took Polly to see the house for the first time. Maybe by the end, you'll believe me. Daddy, Daddy, who's that man in the window? What's wrong with his head? Our daughter saw him, Andras, when she first walked up to the house before we ever moved in, before we even started renovations. How excited he must have been to spot another young soul, so young and innocent. It took Megs and I so much longer than that. I'm sure that was by design. Andras doesn't seem to prefer to want to scare anyone away too quickly. Why would he? He thrives on conflict, on division and discord. He's the destroyer of harmony. They say he's one of the most powerful of all the known demons, and that he prefers sowing discord to dealing death. He can and will, of course, take your life as well, but first, he wants you to suffer. And for some of his victims, he would rather let you live and carry the burden of what terrible things you did under his hideous influence than to just destroy you completely. Over the course of the winter and spring, we sunk just under another $1 million into the house to get it ready for guests for the summer. We spent pretty much every weekend working there as well. And come June, that place did shine and sing. We also ignored all the warning signs that something was wrong with it. 2 of the workers died in 2 separate incidents. Strange incidents. In the first, a young man named Mark, something or other, from Cannon Beach, a real funny, quick-to-laugh guy who always seemed to have a smile on his face, he fell from the roof and impaled his head on one of the spikes on the decorative wrought iron fence that surrounds the house. Well, I say fell, but that's not true. He was thrown. The house threw him. No one else was on the roof with him when he died, so some person didn't push or throw him, and he didn't just slip. No one saw him die, but the fence where he fell, it's a good 20 feet past the edge of the roof. You can't fall and still hit that. It's literally impossible. I don't even think most people could jump that far, even if they gave themselves a little running head start. The other guy, I feel terrible that I don't remember his name at all. We never spoke. He died on the stairs. He was carrying up some plumbing supplies, slipped, fell back, and broke his neck. A few guys were nearby and did see him fall, or be pushed, I'm guessing. I never could track them down to ask what happened. They quit that same day. I heard that how it happened was very unnatural. If it wasn't for the insurance our general contractor covered, I think the rest of the restoration might have died when he did. It should have died. It should have died before the house killed him. Another guy, Ben, quiet guy around 50, I guess, who sure didn't seem like the suspicious type, he took me aside not long after that second death, and I'll never forget what he said. It's not too late to cancel your plans, Dom. I know you and your wife have sunk a lot of money into this place, but you can still cut your losses. She's a beauty, but she's rotten. I've never seen more men leave a job because they were scared of the building that they were working on in my life. I've never seen so much fighting on one job. Everyone's always at each other's throats. Something's very wrong with this house. I think he wanted to say more. Something like, the devil is in this house. He nervously rubbed his crossed necklace he always wore the entire time he spoke. But I think he stopped because he guessed that those words would have fallen on deaf ears. And maybe they would have. I'm sure he'd already seen some of the bumper stickers on my Subaru, ones that say stuff like coexist and equal rights for others does not mean fewer rights for you. He probably thought I would have laughed, in his face or otherwise, if he would have brought up the devil to me. But now I would have listened to him. But now it's too late. What's been done is done. A little over 8 months after Polly saw someone in the window, and less than 2 months after that second worker died, the house was ready for us. Boy, was it ever. And we moved in. That first night, I had a dream. Not the dream I shared with you earlier. Just a dream where Megs, Polly, and I, we weren't alone in our new house. Even if we had no guests, we weren't alone. We were all being watched by something, by some dark entity. One that maybe had wings. One with a head that wasn't human. Big round eyes. And it wasn't alone. Another creature was with it. It was all a little blurry and hard to remember when I woke up. Megs and Polly started to have bad dreams too. They could never seem to remember what they were when they woke up though. Soon we would all see and hear things while we were awake. Things, at least I, would never forget. But during the day, those first few weeks, our life was magical. It was everything Megs and I had hoped it would be. So much laughter, so many smiles, so much love, so many sweet and grateful. We are living the dream, glances exchanged between Megs and I as we played with our daughter out in the yard or weeded the vegetable garden in the sun, splashed in the swimming pool out back, or made big breakfast for guests in the kitchen. No matter what we were doing, it was just so nice to always be together. And we felt so much pride as guest after guest told us how beautiful our new home was, how lucky we were to be able to live there, how beautiful of a family we were. Before it was hell, it was heaven. Before we get into our next sequence of scares, it is time for our mid-show sponsor break. If you don't want to hear these ads, please become a Robert or Annabelle on the Scared to Death Patreon and get these nightmare fuel stories and all other Scared to Death episodes ad-free and more. What is the most basic gift you have ever given the moms in your life for Mother's Day? Flowers? A candle? Some random knickknack you picked up at the last minute because you completely spaced Mother's Day?
I have definitely made the mistake of procrastinating gifts for Mother's Day, and then, like the Friday before, I run to whatever store is open and convince myself that, yes, my mom does need another coffee mug that declares she's the world's best. So lame.
This year, how about one upping yourself by giving the moms in your life an Aura picture frame? Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to any mom at any age. Aura frames connect easily to Wi-Fi and have unlimited storage so you can share as many pictures as you want.
This year, as many of you know, I am on a spending freeze, but one of my carve-outs was meaningful gifts for the people I love. I don't want to give all of the moms in our lives something that won't bring them joy. We are giving Aura frames to the moms in our world because they are timeless, heartwarming gifts.
Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A frames.com. Use code SCARED at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What are the things that weigh you down on a day-to-day basis? What kind of stress are you holding on to? Do you spend much of your day going over things in your brain over and over until they are so distracting it affects your mental health? Well, don't worry. You're not alone.
We all carry different stressors, some big, some small. When we keep things bottled up, the results can be negative. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest without fear or judgment. It's a place to work through what is heavy on your mind and heart so that you can feel lighter and happier.
I'm always holding on to something. It's the way my anxious brain works. I'm continually worried that I've done something wrong, that I've hurt the feelings of someone I love, and that I have let someone down. I'm stressed that I'm not being a good enough mom or wife. I panic that our life will implode at any given moment and it'll all be my fault. Thankfully, I have an amazing therapist who helps me talk through each of these scenarios. After each and every appointment, I feel lighter, happier, and more capable of showing up as my most authentic self.
Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/scaredtodeath today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/scaredtodeath.
Summer is just around the corner. Who's excited? I know I am. With the warmer, sunnier days calling your name, the last place you're going to want to be is in your kitchen, cooking and meal prepping. Make your life easier with Factor's no prep, no mess meals.
Factor's never frozen, always fresh meals are dietitian approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Think of all the extra time you will get outside in the summer sun when you aren't wasting hours in the kitchen.
I think I speak for everyone when I say that the summer is the busiest time of the year. We are all trying to cram in as many things as possible, from concerts to vacations and everything in between. With Kyler home from college and Monroe on her break too, I want to spend as much time as possible with them. And while I truly love to cook, the summer is the one time of year that I'm the least interested in doing that for 3 meals a day. So I lean on Factor to help keep me healthy and in step with my diet. I'm obsessed with the honey yogurt pancakes for breakfast, the pork al pastor for lunch, and the cilantro lime barramundi for dinner. So easy and saves me so much time.
Head to factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 and use code scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month. That's code scaredtodeath50 at factormeals.com/scaredtodeath50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Thank you for not leaving. Now back to Dom and Megs, learning a little bit more about their new dream home. Dom, be really quiet and listen. Do you hear that? It was 10 or so in the evening, about a month after we'd moved in. It was a Monday night, and the last of our weekend guests had left that morning. Polly was already asleep when Megs heard it, and we were having a drink on the first floor, sitting in what used to be the parlor when the house was first built, a big open room at the bottom of the stairs, just inside the front door that was now our lobby. You really don't hear that scratching sound? She'd been hearing this sound here and there for about a week, and a few of our guests had heard it the previous weekend. One even told me, matter of fact, that we had mice in the walls. Since I hadn't heard anything yet, and Megs wasn't sure what she had heard, we hadn't called an exterminator. But now I finally understood what she was talking about. Oh yeah, is that what you've been hearing lately? Yes. Does it sound like mice to you? It was coming from the ceiling, directly above us. It did sound like scratching, but not like mice. We'd had mice in the walls in this one old house I'd lived in for a few years when I was a kid in Eugene. It's a very distinct sound. It's soft. Like if you took your hand, put it against the wall, and moved your fingers to scratch the wall, as if you were tickling someone. The sound your fingernails make when you move your hand like that, that's the sound that mice make. A squirrel makes even less sound. I looked it up on YouTube to be sure. But this was deeper and heavier. Instead of a mouse, it made me think of the sound that something as big as a mountain lion would make if it started trying to slowly dig into the floor with its claws. No, that sounds like something a lot bigger than a mouse. We both sat in silence, staring up at the ceiling as the sound continued. After exchanging a bit of a, "What the hell is that?" glance, I got up, and both of us, making as little noise as possible, we headed towards the stairs. As quiet as we could be, as if we were the mice hiding in the house now. Which I guess we were in a way, We just didn't know what we were hiding from yet. We walked up the stairs and then down the hall towards the source of the sound, the Flavel Suite, named for this old prominent ship captain in the area when the town was founded. Both of us stood just outside the door, still listening as the sound continued. And it didn't sound like the clawing or scratching was coming from inside the floor. It sounded like it was coming from something on top of the floor, something in the bedroom. Motioning to Meg for her to stay where she was, I grabbed the doorknob and slowly turned it. Then, trying to catch whatever it was in the act, I swung the door open as fast as I could while quickly stepping inside the room and turning on the overhead light. Nothing. I looked all around, standing fully inside the room now, as Meg stepped into the doorway. See anything? I didn't. No. You? Before she could speak, we both heard it. The same deep scratching sound, or clawing, rather, from before. It started underneath the floor, near where we stood, then slowly moved along the floor, away from us. We couldn't see anything, but we heard it, moving up the wall opposite us, gaining speed before finally exploding out across the ceiling. As if one creature had been making the noise originally, but now there were 100, all of them racing across the ceiling in various directions at the same time. It was intense. Megs screamed, and so did I. Only a second or two after the explosive scratching began, the noise stopped entirely, cutting off abruptly, and the house was now completely and eerily silent. Our screaming had woken up Polly, who now started crying out for us, and right after Megs turned and asked, "What the fuck was that?" And I told her I had no idea. We headed towards Polly's room. And as we passed the staircase, just for a moment, although I didn't say anything to Megs, who, like me, was already spooked, I thought I saw a dark figure with large, round eyes, wings, hovering outside a second-floor window. But it disappeared so quickly, I figured it was just my mind playing tricks on me, since we'd both just gotten so worked up. I'd convinced myself by the next day that I hadn't seen anything, really. But I had. I'd seen Andras. And Andras had seen me. Well, I now saw him see me. I'm sure he'd been watching me, all of us, for a while now. Megs and I, after getting Polly back to sleep that night, definitely talked about what happened when we returned down to the lobby and refreshed our drinks. And we talked about it the next day, and the day after that, and so forth, for a week or so, I'm sure. But when the next wave of guests started showing up on Wednesday, we got busy, and the intensity of what had happened faded. Megs called an electrician at some point, thinking it might have been some strange electrical anomaly, and he said something that made sense to her, and that was pretty much where the incident ended for a while. For the next few weeks, Megs and I would never see or hear anything, at least not together. That was his new game. Megs would hear and see things alone. I still don't know exactly what she saw or heard, and so did I. And so did Polly. And our harmonious, peaceful new life, our dream, it began to sour. It started to rot. "Please, just tell me what you did with her. Polly, your mother and I have told you several times now that we didn't do anything with your doll. We have no idea where you left her." "You're lying. He told me he would do this. You don't want me to have any fun." Polly, after accusing us of hiding her doll, some monster pie doll named Spectra or something, she slammed her bedroom door. "Who is he?" I asked Megs. And she acted like Polly hadn't just said that. "What are you talking about?" "She just said that he told me you would do this. So who's he?" "She didn't say that." Meg's tone was accusatory, like I just decided to randomly make that up. Why would I do that? For what reason? "Yes. Yes, she definitely did, Megs. She clearly said..." Megs snapped before storming off. "I don't have time for this right now." I stood there so confused and pissed off at both my wife and my daughter. I think in my mind, I actually thought something along the lines of, "Of course Polly's being a little bitch. She gets it from her mom." I'd never thought anything like that before we moved into that house. Then I heard Polly talking to someone through her door. "You were right. They're liars. They just don't want me to be happy." "Yes? Uh-huh. I think they should get in trouble. Kids can get in trouble. Why can't moms and dads?" I quickly opened her door. "Polly, who are you? Get out! Get out of my room! Just leave me alone!" I about snapped back at her with something like, "You don't talk to your father like that." And I think I actually thought about hitting her as well for a split second. But then, glancing around the room and recognizing that she was clearly alone, I just shut the door and walked out. I actually walked all the way out of the house to calm down, out to the edge of the fence near our neighbor's property, and stood by this little peach tree. I'd come to love that little spot. It always just felt nice there. Light. Even when things started to get bad in the house. Quickly, I began to feel a lot better. Like a fog I didn't even know had been in my head had been lifted. And I texted Megs, asked if she could come out to where I was and talk. And she did. Hey, sorry if I seemed snappy in there. I was just so caught off guard by how Polly was acting. No, I'm sorry. I just wasn't feeling like myself. Have you felt moody lately? I've been all over the place. Yes, I said. Me too. I felt really angry and accusatory lately in moments and paranoid. And I don't know why. Right now, I feel fine. Like myself. Megs gave me a great big hug. It's probably just been the stress of adjusting to our new life. Learning how to do this bed and breakfast thing, it's fun. So much fun. But change, any change, is still stressful. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is. I'll work on being a lot more patient. Me too. We have to remember that we're living the dream. What's the point if we don't enjoy it? While still hugging each other, I looked up at the third floor attic window over Meg's shoulder and saw that face I'd seen before outside the window by the stairs on the night we heard the scratching. The face of Andras. Just a flash for a second or two tops. He seemed to float up to the window, pause, look at me, then float back away from the window, retreating back into the dark room. Again, I said nothing to Megs. I tried to force myself to think I was imagining it. I didn't want to ruin the sweet moment we were having. Megs and I were not able to maintain the patience with each other we just talked about. Not for long at all. Within a day or two, we were back to snapping at one another. But not consistently. We'd get into a fight over nothing 1 minute and then be apologizing the next. Same with Polly. She'd be really mad at one of us, or both of us, out of nowhere. And then just a few minutes later, it was like it never happened, and she was fine. We also started to hear that scratching noise here and there, but never as intense as that one night. And we had a few guests who complained about hearing it. Polly also had some night terrors, but that was it, as far as I know, when it came to anything that could be considered paranormal. Things weren't great, but they weren't terrible either. But then, I don't know, halfway through the summer, it started to get really bad. I woke up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom attached to our bedroom. Megs and I had been getting along great when we'd fallen asleep. Then, half awake, in the bathroom with the lights on in the middle of taking a piss, I thought I saw movement in the damask wallpaper pattern on the wall to my left. Suddenly, one grouping of leaves and flowers seemed to resemble the face I'd seen twice before now, the Owl Man, as I thought of him at that time. But then a moment later, it became the pattern it was supposed to be again. A second or two after that, out of the corner of my eye, to the right now, I saw the pattern move once more. And again, it transformed into that same face. But this time, as I finished using the toilet and pulled up the front of my boxers, instead of morphing back into the floral pattern it was supposed to be, it changed further. A black humanoid body replaced the floral and leafy arrangement beneath its head. Dark wings sprouted from its back. I was horrified. I also couldn't look away. I remained transfixed as this creature began to move across the wall, like the wallpaper had suddenly turned into one giant animated screen, and it was moving towards me. It kept moving through the wallpaper pattern until it was directly in front of me at eye level above the back of the toilet. And then it transformed further. A black wolf appeared, a wolf nearly as big as this strange dark angel with the head of an owl. And then that wolf bared its fangs and roared. And as it roared, it grew larger, as did Andras. Finally, they were just as big as I was. Still, I stood frozen, and I remained silent. My mind couldn't process what I was seeing. And now the dark angel opened its owl's beak, and a black mist flowed out from its mouth, headed towards mine. That snapped me out of my trance. I fell back and screamed. I stumbled out the door and back into my bedroom, headed to wake up Megs, who was already up and walking towards me. But strangely, she didn't seem alarmed. She was smiling in a way that scared the hell out of me. I turned back around to see if that thing was right behind me, but it had vanished. When I turned again to face Megs, now she looked concerned, like I would have expected her to look. Dom, are you all right? What happened? I tried to shake off how she'd appeared before and managed to stammer. I saw something in the bathroom. She moved past me to look and I followed. Of course, he was gone. As I scanned the bathroom looking in the wallpaper pattern to find him, my eyes moved across the mirror and caught Meg's reflection. Her face was missing its skin. All of its skin. Ah! I screamed out and stumbled backwards, falling onto the floor. Meg spun around and again, she looked like she was supposed to. I was panicking. I'd taken too much acid once back in college, and it felt like that. Like I was suddenly in the middle of a bad trip. Like I couldn't get my mind to pick what reality was supposed to look like, and the world around me kept shifting in scary and unpredictable ways. Then, right as Meg started to ask me something, Polly started screaming, like she'd just woken up from a nightmare, and Meg took off towards her room. I popped up and followed. By the time I made it, the light was on, and Meg's was sitting in a rocking chair with Polly on her lap. And Andras stood next to them both. What are you? Get away from them! Dom, stop! You're scaring us! Meg smiled that creepy smile from before as she yelled at me. And Andras, he put a hand on her shoulder, and she leaned towards him. Then I heard his wolf. It was sitting on my daughter's bed to my left, looking at me with his intense, soulless eyes and snarling. I freaked out. I ran down the hall and then down the stairs. I unlocked the front door and ran outside over to the peach tree, the only place I felt safe. I was so scared I was crying like a child. Not knowing what else to do, I just sat down on the ground. I buried my head in my hands and just sobbed. 15 or so minutes later, Meg's came out. At first, I was afraid of how she'd look, how she'd act. But she was herself again. She looked concerned. She brought a blanket, asked me what was going on, and said that I needed to see a doctor. I'd woken up some guests, and one of them had seen me run out of the building only wearing my underwear. I was still in just my underwear, crying out under a tree in the yard in the middle of the night. Not a good look. The next day, all but one couple would check out early. I tried to explain everything that I saw to Meg's, and she looked more concerned than ever. She swore that what she had seen in that same sequence of events was very different. She was worried about me. Very worried. I was worried about me. I agreed to call a doctor in the morning, but in my gut, I didn't think it would help. And I'd be right. The doctor was able to get me in just 3 days later. She guessed that I probably had some kind of night terror, something akin to sleepwalking, but while having a nightmare. She thought it would most likely be an anomaly, a one-time thing, but did agree to schedule an MRI to have my brain scanned just to rule out the remote possibility of a tumor. But I wouldn't be able to get in for another 3 weeks. In the meantime, I just have to hope it didn't happen again. Fortunately, Andras had decided to leave me alone for a little while. Maybe he knew if he pushed me too much harder at that point, I would have just been committed, and then I wouldn't be around for him to toy with. I don't know. I could tell Megs was still worried about me, and Polly too. Megs tried to be comforting and warm, but I saw that she had to work at it. Underneath her attempts, I felt like she was both very frustrated and angry with me. I was letting her down. It was mostly my dream that she had used her inheritance for, and now I was starting to hurt our business, our very expensive business. Something like that is what I suspected she was feeling, but who knows if that was true. I'll never know what was really happening, how people were really acting, because what I was seeing wasn't ever necessarily there, or at least it wasn't what everyone around me was also seeing. Such a confusing mental space to live in. But then just the day after I saw the doctor, I got some clarification. From the most unlikely place, I began to understand what was really going on. I ran into one of our neighbors for just the second time since we'd moved in, Sam Marsh. He'd first introduced himself when we were fixing up the place. And now I remembered how he'd said something strange that day. He looked at Polly, seemed concerned when I told him we'd all be moving in soon. And he said, "Giving it a go, huh? I hope it's better now. I'd be mighty surprised, but I hope so. I suppose even the sickest houses can still get well." I thought maybe he meant it hadn't been a good business opportunity for any of the previous owners. Now I understand what he was really saying. Sam was an old guy, 88, but real with it. He was still pruning his own fruit trees, mowing his lawn, and he told me he'd replaced some shingles on his roof the previous summer. He told me he'd lived on the property next door since he was 30. That's when he bought it, back in 1967. He'd been in the same place, has been in the same place for coming up on 60 years. When I asked him if he knew much about the history of my property, he knew a lot. I learned how many people had lived in the place, and he told me about that second group of owners, where it all went wrong. Satanists, he said plainly. Not everyone called them a cult, but that's what they were. Called themselves the Children of Midnight. I got the chills when he said that. They were always up late. Sometimes if you walked over to the fence here, which I did because I ain't ashamed to say I can be as nosy as the next fella, I don't like to wonder who my neighbors are. I like to know, if you understand me. And I could hear them chanting, speaking other languages, dressed up in robes and masks too. I saw it all through the windows. And just before they left, they did something in that house, something real bad. A couple of days before they disappeared, one of their lots showed up on my porch in the middle of the night, young fella, completely naked and shaking and making a big fuss. I came out on my porch with my Winchester and damn near shot him. I was married with two small children. Some other cult folk soon came and got him a few months later, and apologizing, saying he'd taken too much of this or that. He'd gotten too high, but they'd take care of him. I don't think that's what it was at all. Right before the rest showed up, he looked at me, and half proud and half terrified, he said, and I've never forgot it. We did it. We goddamn did it. He's awake. He's here and he's real. He's with us. They said he's going to make us the most powerful men in the world. And then he looked the most scared I've ever seen anyone look. And he added, but they were wrong. He's going to take us to hell. He's going to eat our souls. Most folks, I imagine, would call the police at that point, or pointed the rifle at him and threatened to shoot if he didn't start running right away. Most folks would have assumed he's just on drugs. But for whatever reason, his words chilled me to the bone, and I believed him. I felt like they really had done something, still do. And I asked him, just as his friends approached, who's he? And he said, with his eyes as wide as eyes can be, Andross, the mightiest Marquis of Hell. Only Satan himself, his master, is more powerful. That's what he said. And then he started laughing this mad laugh. And by that point, his friends were grabbing him to take him home. After all I'd been through, I didn't doubt a word of what Mr. Marsh was saying. He continued, 2 days later, that whole lot, except their head honcho, was gone. And he only stayed around a week or so to help sell the place. I never saw him, never saw any of them, ever again after that night. I heard they all headed down to San Francisco, but I don't believe it. I don't think most of them, maybe none of them, ever left the property. Folks have been dying, going mad there ever since. Mr. Hatch now proceeded to share some details about a few of the owners over the years. He mentioned suicides and at least two murders. He spoke of a bunch of disappearances and some disturbing encounters with a few owners shortly before they too disappeared or were taken away. People who had lost their minds, talking about seeing or hearing all sorts of strange stuff. Finally, before he headed back over to his house, he warned me. Leave and don't look back, Mr. Gordon. You look haunted. I've seen that look before. Too many times now. Maybe I was wrong about what I said earlier. Maybe some places are so sick, they can never be healed. Some places just need to die. Better off to burn them down to keep their sickness from spreading. Then he looked past me up towards the attic, and some of the color seemed to leave his face. He turned around and shuffled back towards his house, never saying another word, moving a little faster. Then he moved when he walked over to greet me. I turned and looked up towards the window as well. There he was, just who I expected, Andross. This time he didn't bother to quickly float back into the darkness. He lingered, he stayed and stared down upon me for a good 5 or 6 seconds. My blood ran cold. And then he faded back into the house, and I steeled myself for heading inside to join him. I had to. My family was still inside. When I headed back in, I told Megs about the conversation I just had with Mr. Hatch, and she just slowly nodded, clearly concerned that I thought any of what he said might have some merit. And she mentioned that she was glad I had my MRI on the books. She also told me to come with her to check out the attic. She wanted me to see that it was empty, that no entity called Andross was up there. It was all in my head. I brought up that night we both heard the terrible scratching, how she'd been hearing it before me. Was that just in my head? Were the nightmares she'd also been having some nights, the nightmares Polly had also been having, were those just all in my head too? She acted like none of that had ever happened. And she was so convincing that for a moment I did wonder if it was all in my head. Maybe I did have a brain tumor. Wouldn't that be something? I get just a taste of my dream life. Then a tumor takes it all away from me. There was nothing in the attic. Nothing I could see anyway. I doubted myself further. Was it really, truly, all in my head? But what about Mr. Marsh? Why would he say what he said? Did I imagine my entire conversation with him? Was I having that much trouble processing reality? A quick internet search would prove to me that this was not all in my mind. I got out my laptop and searched for Andras. And when I saw what images came up, I literally jumped out of my seat. It was him. It was exactly who I'd seen in the window, outside of the window, in the wallpaper, in my daughter's room. The 63rd infernal entity, said to have been named when conjured by King Solomon in the 10th century BCE. An exceptionally dangerous demon lord. A humanoid figure donning the wings of an angel and sporting the head of an owl. Often depicted riding or walking with a robust black wolf that some believe to be Marcosius, another powerful demon lord. He's said to be one of the most violent and perilous demons to summon, known first for sowing discord and second for dealing death, able to turn people against each other, fueling their anger, letting their anger turn into a murderous rage. He's said to be able to give the conjurer the answers to all the secrets on earth, secrets that come with immense power and wealth, but also come at a terrible price, a price that wasn't named when I found. Had I read all that 3 months earlier, I would have literally rolled my eyes or laughed out loud. Actually, I wouldn't have read it all because I would have firmly believed it was just a bunch of made-up fairy tale bullshit, that Andras was no more real than the Tooth Fairy or the Easter Bunny. But I saw him. I printed out some pages of what I found, describing him along with some images, and I ran to go back and talk to Megs. The second I started to show them to her, she freaked out. She started screaming at me, saying that she'd had enough, that she was sick of watching me try to destroy what was supposed to be our dream house with all my nonsense. And then little Polly wandered over and glared at me as well, told me to leave Mommy alone. What was happening? I started to ask Polly if she'd ever seen the man in the pictures on the paper I was holding, if that's who she had spoken to in her room, and Megs ripped them out of my hand. She screamed at me to stop scaring our daughter. What is wrong with you? Polly then started to cry and asked, "Why is Daddy doing this?" As she continued to berate me, I saw him again. I saw them standing behind my wife and daughter, Andras and Marcosius, the dark angel and the demon wolf. And this time, there was a bunch of swirling, shadowy faces floating behind them. I now screamed as I pointed behind them. Right there! Don't you see them? We have to get out of this house! Meg screamed back before storming off with Polly. I swear to God, if you don't stop, I'll have you committed. They walked right through Andras and the rest, who lingered a moment longer, and then vaporized into nothing. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't bear the thought of staying in that house any longer, but I also couldn't leave my wife and child in that house. That night, I slept by myself in one of the unused rooms, the Clatsop suite. And it was in that room where I began to have the full dream I started this story with. At first, it was a terrifying nightmare, but soon it started to feel more like a call to action. Some type of prophecy I'd been asked to fulfill. I was losing my mind. In the house, I was starting to see Andras on a daily basis, always watching me, always around. But I stopped fearing him the same way. Instead, I began getting angry. I was only living with his torment because of Megs, because of Polly, because they wouldn't believe me and wouldn't let me leave. They had trapped me in this hell with him. And then, as time went on, I started to think that they were the reason he was always around, that they had somehow invited him into our family's lives, that if they were stronger, we could have kept living our dream life. But they had ruined that. I know none of this is rational, but it's what I believed. Night after night, I continued to sleep alone in the Clatsop suite. Megs and Polly were sleeping together in my bed. We were alone almost every night, the only people in the house, because business had dried up. Our reviews on Google, Yelp, and TripAdvisor were abysmal. Guests reported a filthy house, food that looked spoiled, strange, creepy hosts that didn't seem to care if they had guests or not, and that the place seemed haunted. Strange noises at night, a constant feeling in the house of being watched, the sensation of something crawling into bed with you. Andras was growing stronger and stronger as he sowed more and more discord. and then late one night towards the end of our only summer there, I suddenly felt compelled to enter the basement. We'd only used it for storage, and I hadn't been down much since we'd moved in. I'd almost forgotten about it, honestly. But this night, I woke up with a powerful urge, a need, to go down there. There was something I needed to see, to be shown. The door, which was typically locked, was cracked open, and when I approached, on its own, it opened wide. I was so far gone, this didn't even feel scary. It felt inviting. I descended down the stairs, walked across the concrete floor past some boxes to the end of the basement, or what I thought was the end. In the corner, I now noticed a small door, maybe only 4 feet high. I'd never seen it before. It also opened itself, letting me know I was heading in the right direction. I'd gone down without a light. I hadn't bothered to turn any lights on. Only light from some lamps out in the yard. The moon trickled through a few egress windows, just enough to show me the way. But now additional light poured out from this hidden room, undulating, flickering light, as if from candles. As I entered, I realized that's exactly what it was. Candles. So many candles. All lined along the dirt floor of a massive hidden cellar, probably 30 feet from front to back and 20 or so feet wide. And the space was filled with people in robes. The children of midnight had to be. I couldn't tell if they were real, living people or ghosts. They stood near the center of a massive pentagram, chanting and moving in very specific, synchronized ways, clearly in the midst of some ritual. And in the very center of the pentagram stood Andras, along with his black wolf, Marcosius. And now I was afraid. I was terrified. But still entranced as I was, under the same spell that had led me to the basement, I walked steadily towards the two demons. And as I did, I now noticed more lesser demons, black masses floating and swirling in the periphery. The chanting of the cult grew louder the closer I got to the center. Their synchronized movements quickened. The volume of their collective voices continued to rise. Their movements continued to hasten. The whole ceremony rising and building towards this massive crescendo. And then, when I was close enough to be able to reach out and touch Andras, everything stopped. Every movement, every sound, all was still and silent, as was I. After a moment, Andras moved his avian head close to mine, opened his strange beak, and released a powerful, impossibly loud and horrific roar. And with it came a plume of black mist that turned into a billowing serpent, one that coiled in front of me before striking out and projecting itself into my open mouth and down into my throat. Once it was done, I knew what I must do to end my family's torment. What had to be done. Megs, Polly, and then myself. We all had to die. It was the only way we could ever leave and be free and be happy again. The only way our souls would ever be free. Andras assured me, without ever speaking an actual word, that all the homes, many years of hurt and pain would finally be over. Enough blood would have been shed to pay the original price of his conjuring. And no one would ever have to suffer in the home again. All the souls that had died in the home before would be saved. They'd be free. If I committed this terrible deed, a deed no one in this world would ever understand, I would be a hero. I would have made a brave and noble sacrifice. I don't even remember leaving the basement. One moment I was coming to an understanding of what I must do, and the next I was in the kitchen, holding our largest carving knife in my right hand, and walking towards my bedroom, towards Meg's and Polly. To end it all. I believe you have an idea of what happens next. I wrote all this down at the Cedar Hills inpatient psychiatric facility in Portland, where I'm currently still a patient. Remember my dream from the beginning? The prophecy? The one where I stabbed my wife and daughter to death? I marched up the stairs that night, after the ritual in the basement. I walked into my room, where they were sleeping. I quietly opened the door, stepped inside, and gently closed it behind me. The room was too dark. I needed to really see what I was doing, what must be done, so I turned on the light. It woke Polly first. Rubbing her eyes, she asked, "Daddy, what are you doing with that knife?" That got Meg's attention, as you'd expect. "My God, Dominic, what are you doing?" I didn't address either of them. I wasn't even looking at them when they spoke to me. I was looking past them, at the Black Angel, Andras, at the Demon Wolf, Marcosius. Both standing on the far side of the room past the bed, Andras holding his chain and keeping the snarling Marcosius at bay. Andras nodding and pointing, motioning for me to end them. I moved towards the bed as my girl screamed in terror. And now we're at the point in time just before the vision that I shared earlier, when I ended them both, when the Demon Wolf then ended me. I raised the knife to plunge it down into Meg's as she raised her arms to try and stop me, and I... Dominic, no! I turned to the sound of my neighbor, Mr. Marsh's voice, who was outside down in the yard below looking up at me through the bedroom window. After getting my attention, he hurled a rock about the size of a small apple. He threw a perfect strike, shattering the window. Quite the arm for a man of nearly 90. He yelled again, Max Polly, run! My wife jumped up, throwing the comforter towards and partially over me, grabbing Polly as I wrestled with getting the blanket off, and she ran past me and out the door. Sam yelled once more, It's time to burn it down, Dominic! And he held up a metal container full of gasoline. I turned to face Andras, who was furious. His large owl eyes glowed bright with flames of their own. I had disappointed him. I had failed him. He now held a burning sword in his hand, and he released his hellhound as I turned and ran. I sprinted past swirling lesser demons biting and clawing at me in the hallway and down the stairs. Hearing the wolf behind me, I still don't know how it didn't catch me. Soon I had made it out into the yard. That was when I heard them stop. I looked back and saw the Demon Wolf and the Dark Angel still standing in the doorway. They appeared to be psychically confined to the inside of the house somehow, unable to leave. I ran to Mr. Marsh. He brought over two containers of gasoline. He took a book of matches out of his pocket and tossed them to me and nodded. I knew what to do. I picked up one container and ran to the other side of our beautiful, expensive, freshly restored home, and I poured gas all along that side of the front porch. I threw a rock through another window and poured more inside the home, barely missing the jaws of Marcosius as I did so. And then as I stared directly into the still fiery eyes of Andras, I lit and threw a match. The old house went up fast. The flames reached unnatural heights and the fire roared mightily as I walked back towards the front of the home and met Mr. Marsh to watch. Megs and Polly stood over by his car. They were still scared of me. Can you blame them? We all watched the house burn to the ground. I expected to hear it scream, but the demons, they left silently. Or rather, they didn't leave at all. That night, Mr. Marsh helped coordinate having Megs and Polly get picked up by some friends of ours back in Astoria. I stayed at his house. I learned he came over to our bed and breakfast after hearing the chanting in the basement that night. He said he'd heard it a few times before over the years, and something terrible always followed. The next morning, I told him that I'd need to call my insurance company. He shot me a curious glance and informed me that that might not be necessary. Before I called, he thought we should go check on the house. I asked why. What was there to check on? We'd all watched it burn. He just told me to trust him. When we made it to the property, I understood exactly what he meant. The house was still standing. Not a single board out of place. Absolutely nothing had been burned. But it had. I had seen it. And then up in the attic window, they were back. Andras, with Marcosius by his side. And now, in other windows, there were other beings. Men and women in robes. The children of midnight. The next and last thing I remember from that day was Mr. Marsh saying defeatedly, I figured it would have been too much to tell you this before, but this is the fifth time I've burned that house to the ground. There has to be a way to end this. I just wish to hell I knew what it was. And then I guess I lost my mind for a while. It had all been too much. That was just over 3 weeks ago. I've been at Cedar Hills ever since. They asked me to write all of this out, some type of therapeutic assignment. Get what I remember down on paper. I don't think what they're about to read is going to help me get released. Megs has come to visit me a few times, but not Polly. They don't remember everything quite like I do. They heard scratching, had some bad dreams, but Polly doesn't remember ever talking to any imaginary friend. Megs doesn't remember ever hearing her do that, or anything else. She certainly doesn't ever remember smiling when a demon put its hand on her shoulder. Andras truly is the master of discord. I don't know if my marriage will survive this. Mr. Marsh spoke with Megs, backed up what I was saying, but she thinks he's just like me. Not well. She doesn't remember the fire that night. Neither does Polly. She's put the house back up for sale. She's mad about how much of her inheritance she'll likely lose on it. I tried to tell her that she can't sell it. She can't do that to another family. But she doesn't believe it happened to our family. Why would she believe it would happen to anybody else's family? She sent our realtor, Amira Walton, here to have me co-sign a few papers authorizing the sale. I didn't want to, but I also don't want to lose my marriage. After I signed, Amira put her hand on top of mine, said thank you, and flashed a smile that made my blood run cold. It was the same disturbing smile Megs had flashed at me from Polly's bedroom when Andras had stood beside her. She knows something. I know she does. I think she gave her soul to him. She's connected to the Children of Midnight somehow. I wonder who else in this area is. Maybe I'm not destined for a life along the Oregon coast after all. First, I have to get out of here. And then I have to leave the area and have Megs and Polly come with me. That's all the story I have. For now, at least. Do you believe me? Do you believe that demons are real? And that they can possess not just a person, but a whole place? And that's it for this new chapter of Nightmare Fuel. I hope you loved or were horrified by, or at least entertained by, the Children of Midnight. I hope you're faring better out there than Dominic Gordon. Today's tale was written by me, Dan Cummins, and scored by Logan Keith. If you enjoyed this story, check out the rest of the Bad Magic Productions catalog. Time Suck every Monday at noon Pacific time, with little short sucks on some Fridays, and these Nightmare Fuel episodes on some Fridays as well. And new episodes of the now long-running paranormal podcast, Scared to Death, every Tuesday at midnight. Please go to badmagicproductions.com for all your bad magic needs, including all show-related merch. And stay scared.
Bad Magic Productions.
With chocolate treats mixed into dark chocolate ice cream, the Tillamook Chocolate Collection is a chocolate game changer. Because the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection Ice Cream. Extraordinary dairy.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.